From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, local reaction to the president's Supreme Court pick in immigration policies and how to spend a budget surplus on Beacon Hill.
We believe the resources are there, and we believe this package, based on the months of discussion that have taken place, can make a positive difference in enhancing and improving school safety.
Also, clarifying federal marijuana policies. It's all part of our Week in Review. Plus, the spike in drowning deaths in Massachusetts.
It's remarkably sad because it's totally preventable.
How to stay safe in the water. And director Bo Burnham on his new movie, Eighth Grade, and how he got inside the head of a 13-year-old girl.
Believing that I could understand her let me understand her. People write movies about World War I soldiers, you know what I mean? And like, creatures that live in volcanoes. I can understand a girl.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Happy Friday, everyone, and thanks for joining us. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our Week in Review, beginning with immigration and law enforcement and Attorney General Jeff Sessions' visit to New Hampshire yesterday. Sessions was there to announce new efforts to combat the opioid addiction crisis, and he took aim at the city of Lawrence, Massachusetts.
Prosecutors have brought charges recently against some 50 people involved in distributing fentanyl, including four illegal aliens residing in the sanctuary city of Lawrence, Massachusetts. And there can be no sanctuary for drug dealers and fentanyl dealers in this country.
The mayor of Lawrence took issue with the way Sessions characterized his city and says he might sue the AG for libel. Mayor Dan Rivera says Lawrence has not and will not harbor criminals, documented or undocumented. Sessions' visit came as the Trump administration's immigration policies face another challenge in federal court in Boston.
This isn't about the law. It's about Trump and his efforts to deport immigrants of color.
Also this week, the administration says it's complying with the first part of a court order to reunite some of the migrant children separated from their parents at the border. Asked why it's taking so long, President Trump suggested responsibility for the family separation crisis that his administration created lies elsewhere.
Well, I have a solution. Tell people not to come to our country illegally. That's the solution.
All right. To discuss that solution and others and the rest of the week's news, we have Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group. She's also a former state rep. Hey, Susan.
Hello, Anthony.
Good to see you. And with us as well, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, great to have you.
It's good to be with you.
So let's start with Attorney General Sessions in New Hampshire. He was there to say that he wants to bring charges against anyone suspected of dealing fentanyl. He's in Maine today. He also made that connection between illegal immigration and the opioid crisis. Susan, is that a connection that he should be making? Is there validity to that connection?
Well, should be making, no. I mean, everything is about trying to disparage immigrants, finding a hook to, I think, justify some of their really bad behavior around immigration. And here's another example. Look, I think we all agree the opioid crisis is horrible. You know, fentanyl deaths are on the rise. You know, we're all there, but this demonizing of people is not going to make this a better place or not going to solve this problem. It's really frustrating.
Jim, what's your take on this? Because this is something that the Trump administration comes to back to again and again and again, and his supporters eat it up, this idea that this is why you need strong borders, because drugs are pouring into the country.
Well, you know, I take what Susan said and said the demonization piece of this is what's problematic. So if you're demonizing people with a sort of a broad brush, it's a huge issue. To say that fentanyl's not coming through the border is probably not factual, but also it comes through a lot of other places, too. So to lay all the blame on a lack of a border wall, or to take that even five steps further and say we need to demonize people, that's a big problem. I think a lot of people who support Trump in this take the view that it's a question of the rule of law. And while that's a respectable perspective, the fact is the treatment of refugees is also a matter of rule of law, too. So, you know, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because that's another issue that I want to move on to, and that is this issue of family separations, why it's taking so long to reunite these families. The administration has already missed one deadline. My understanding is, I think as of today, they're 2 days past a deadline where they reunited about 50-something kids with their families. So here's Chris Meekins, the Health and Human Services Department, speaking to reporters on Tuesday, stressing that his agency must continue, is trying to follow strict protocols, including DNA testing of children and families before reuniting them.
Each step of our process is necessary to protect children. Eliminating any one of these steps will endanger children.
All right. So, Jim, obviously a really complicated situation of matching these children with their parents, DNA testing. But, of course, this is all to resolve a whole lot of confusion that was created by the Trump policy in the first place. What do you make of this?
Completely agree. The one thing I would say is if you take a look at the under five population, that's the 103 kids they're dealing with. 57 of them were reunited to their parents. That means 46 were not. And the reasons are not fully known to us. They put into a set of categories that include people. These are kids who are not actually with their parents.
Yeah.
These could be loved ones. They could be uncles. They could be aunts. They could be human traffickers. And we just don't know. And I guess I really want people to start talking from facts. So I'd like to know what the heck this looks like on the other side of that, because 46 kids that are not categorized yet is a lot out of 103.
Yeah. Susan, what do you make of this?
Well, I'd like to start talking from why did they do this in the first place? They, you know, started criminalizing immigrants crossing the border, breaking up their families, using kids as political pawns with no policy or plan for how they were ever going to reunite people. So I kind of get frustrated with talking about, well, we've got 46 people, and to Jim's point, you know, some facts, some not, to try to zero in on perhaps one situation where there's maybe an issue with the parent or not. But the reality is why did we do this in the first place? Why did we break up these families? We're not supposed to do that. And I sort of almost don't even want to talk about this granular issue. I want to focus on the absurdity and horror of the policy in the first place.
It's interesting. I think in another era, a story like this would have probably stayed on the front page for a really long time, and we would have been talking about it. But in this era of the Washington chaos machine, and here we are talking about the possible end of NATO and beating up on allies in Britain, but no, now everything is perfect. I mean, it's just one kind of chaotic moment after another. A story like this, where we're talking, as you suggest, about children being ripped away from their parents, it like falls away.
Yeah, it's too much. I think all of us have had the conversation of just when you think you've sort of hit the bottom, it's lower again when these things happen. I've never seen anything quite like this.
Mm. Well, sort of not heeding my own warning, I need to move on to some other stories. Also this week, two cases in Boston federal court involving immigration. The first is a plea from a Brazilian mother living in Massachusetts to be immediately reunited with her 9-year-old son. The pair had been separated for almost 2 months after crossing the U.S.-Mexican border. The other case is a challenge to the Trump administration's decision to terminate temporary protected status for a group of immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador, and Honduras. They were allowed to live here without fear of deportation, but the administration now says that they no longer need humanitarian protection because conditions in their home countries have improved. Their advocates were in court yesterday calling the policy racially motivated because it affects largely immigrants of color. Jim, I know two cases, they're related, but sort of take a whack at either one of these or both of these in any way you can. What do you
make? Let me take on the temporary protected status piece, and then let me just go back to what Tracy was saying before. I think we often get into this thing of sort of we've been conditioned by Facebook, either we like or we dislike. The fact is, these are heinous policies, but also I don't think we should turn our heads from facts. And those are some of the facts I was trying to get at before. In this case, the fact is that the Trump administration is like a carpenter who has a hammer and a nail and thinks everything deserves a hammer and a nail to advance its own interests. The TPS stuff, the temporary protected status stuff, is clearly treating people sort of in a utilitarian way to gain leverage. And that is what Trump does all the time with NATO, with immigrants. Everything is to gain leverage. And what he's trying to do is to split, in essence, the folks who are advocates for legal immigrants from those who are advocates for illegal or undocumented immigrants.
Yeah. Right. Susan?
Yeah. And we're playing this game, and there are over 250,000 kids of these immigrants who are in our country who will be separated from their parents if they're sent back. We have the Department of Homeland Security who has issued warnings not to travel to those countries because they're dangerous, while we have the president saying there's no problem there anymore. And we have the diplomats from those countries saying, don't do this. This is going to cause chaos there. So to Jim's point about facts, all of the facts point to not making this decision. And the callousness of sort of discarding all of those kids and families and doing it in contradiction to two U.S. agencies, to what end?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll leave that question hanging there. Let's move on to another national story with big local impact, and that is President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to succeed retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh currently serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He teaches at Harvard Law. So here's Judge Kavanaugh Monday night after President Trump introduced him.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
So before I bring you two in on this, we got some local reaction. We spoke to Ron Cass. He's Dean Emeritus of Boston University School of Law, who knows Judge Kavanaugh personally. Here's what he said.
He's very thoughtful, very measured, and very committed to following precedent and to obeying the law and to seeing that the law is interpreted and applied in a reasonable and predictable way.
So Senate Republicans are promising a swift confirmation process, while Democrats, who are outnumbered in the Senate, as we know, are promising to oppose him. So here's a bit of what Elizabeth Warren told us. She's worried that Kavanaugh's confirmation could lead to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the Affordable Care Act. She's also worried about this.
He has written an article saying, in effect, that presidents like Trump should be above the law. They should not be subjected to investigations. I want you to think about that. Not the kind of investigation that Richard Nixon was subjected to, that Bill Clinton was subjected to. No, that presidents are above the law.
So, Susan, I'll start with you. And Elizabeth Warren there is referring to some writings that Kavanaugh did in 2009, 3 years after Bush appointed him to the D.C. Circuit Court, where he basically, I mean, the argument was basically presidents are too busy to get in, to be involved in criminal investigations and civil suits. But what's your overall reaction to this choice?
Two things. I mean, you know, I agree with Elizabeth Warren. I find a kind of an irony in his position on that, given that he was Ken Starr's assistant in the Whitewater investigation of Bill Clinton. So there's that. But put that aside. For me, there are two things that really concern me. One is the Heritage Foundation list, which is what he was chosen from, which Kavanaugh was chosen from. And I do ask myself, what did you have to do to get on the list, and what did you have to promise? And I think we should understand that. You know, why? Who is, you know, who's the group, and what did they tell people? But more importantly, I feel like the other thing that no one is talking about is the nuclear option. Hmm. And that's what we have here.
You're talking about the majority vote in the Senate.
Absolutely.
As opposed to the 61 vote threshold.
Correct.
Right.
It's always been a 61 threshold. Now, I know that, you know, we'll go back and we'll say Harry Reid changed it. He did not change it for Supreme Court nominees. He changed it for cabinet positions and lower court positions because they were stalled. Probably the wrong choice. But to change this for Supreme Court nominees, which they did for Gorsuch and which they're going to do here, assures that we're always going to get extremely polarized members of the Supreme Court. And that is a real problem for our country. We are divided enough as it is. But to take that division and to just continue to hammer us deeper and deeper apart, I worry about that probably more than any specific issue in terms of moving forward and how we choose people who have lifetime appointments and have the final say on many policies in our society.
It's really interesting that you brought that up. And Jim, one of the things that Elizabeth Warren sort of said to me the other day when I was talking to her was, you know, Kavanaugh is not a consensus choice. And Susan's talking about the very issue that sort of makes it impossible to be a consensus
Absolutely.
Choice if we're just talking about a 51-vote majority. Interesting. What do you think?
Well, yeah, a consensus choice seems to be pretty hard when you can't get a justice approved, like Merrick Garland, right? And
yeah.
It just everything gets stalled out. So I think consensus is left. And one thing I just remind folks, people always say, well, after Bork got borked, as they said, you know, in, I think it was 88 or 87.
This was Reagan's choice.
This was Reagan's choice.
Yeah.
They said, well, things have gotten a lot worse. And they have. But I would remind people that, you know, Nixon went through two different nominees before he got Harry Blackmun, right? So, I mean, it's not like this comes in waves. What I would say about this, about Kavanaugh, what I've read about him is he seems to be a very solid, scholarly judge with good temperament. I think that Ron Cass is using code word, trying to tell us not to worry about Roe v. Wade because he says, well, he follows precedent, right? I don't know all that.
Yeah.
I don't know all that. What I would say is I think he is, Akhil Reed wrote in the New York Times, you know, a liberal's case for Kavanaugh. And he makes some really good points about his scholarship, his engagement in developing clerks and getting clerks who are actually on the working for Supreme Court justices, all that sort of thing. But what I would say is you don't really know. What's interesting about this in terms of the impact, what is interesting about the nominee is that every president who's wanted to skirt difficult situations has gone for someone with a thin resume. This fellow has a very thick resume.
Yeah, there's a lot to look at in terms of his legal writings. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And I think that Jeff Jacoby's piece and just good government would require that he goes through a thorough vetting.
Hmm.
I would say that in terms of his own politics, it seems like he's somewhere between Kennedy and Gorsuch. Kennedy is a little more right-leaning than most people would like to say right now. They're saying, well, he's a middle guy. He's a middle guy in a right-leaning horde. And I think that that Kavanaugh will be that plus a little more towards Gorsuch.
So I have a question about Roe v. Wade, and I sort of want to set it up this way. So there's an interesting development on Beacon Hill. So House Speaker Robert Leo has said that the House plans on voting on a bill that would eliminate a series of antiquated laws, including one from 100 years ago that bans abortions. The law has been unenforceable because of Roe v. Wade, but it's still on the books. And given the changes on the Supreme Court, there's a bunch of state lawmakers on Beacon Hill that are moving to strike it from the books. The Senate has already done it. The House hasn't done it yet. But all of this, and I'll put this to you, Susan, sort of leads to this big question about Roe versus Wade and the possibility that a Justice Kavanaugh could lead to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. What do you think?
My fear on that would be if I don't know. Of course, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know if that will happen. But my fear would really be that there's this push to kind of do what you just say, which is to push this into the states.
Yeah.
And I think when you do that, you're just going to have very unequal opportunity for women and families and their medical choices across this country. And that seems to me probably where this would head. You know, Massachusetts will probably do, you know, protect Roe versus Wade, but that won't be true in every state. And so women will have unequal opportunity for health care in across the country. And that seems to be what I would fear the most.
Yeah. Final question. I mean, what are the Democrats to do here? I mean, I take your point, Susan, about the nuclear option, but the Democrats are still in a minority in the Senate. They're probably two or three red state Democrats that might well support putting Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. So what's the approach here? Is it just to sort of fall on their sword and go down fighting? But, I mean, can they do anything? I guess I'll ask you this, Jim. I mean, can they actually do anything to prevent the Republicans getting their choice?
The Senate has frequently destroyed nominees. You could certainly destroy him in a way that Bork was, or that's, I mean,
to
you could
Bork
go after
him.
His, you can absolutely try to assassinate his character. I think a more profitable way that gets to substance is both Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, I think, have some real concerns about this. And Susan Collins has herself said, if I don't get some sort of, maybe not ironclad guarantee, but representations as to how he would treat precedent specifically related to Roe v. Wade, I don't know that I can actually support him. I don't know how that plays out, whether she's saying that, telling the truth or not, but I would actually play there first and see where you get with that. The problem is you do have folks like Joe Manchin who probably will vote for this candidate, so even if you lose one.
Yeah.
So,
Interesting dynamic. Okay, well, let's move on. I sort of brought us back to Beacon Hill there. So there are a few issues pending before the legislative session ends at the end of this month. So first issue, the Baker administration says it expects about a $1 billion revenue surplus for the fiscal year that ended June 30th, where about half the money is going to be deposited into the state's so-called rainy day fund. And today, the governor asked lawmakers to direct part of the surplus towards school safety, including hardening school facilities, hiring more social workers, and mental health professionals. Here's a bit of what he said about that.
We believe the resources are there, and we believe this package, based on the months of discussion that have taken place between folks on our teams and folks in local government, can make a positive difference in enhancing and improving school safety.
So, Susan, good use of the surplus, school safety?
You know, I feel like the first thing we have to do is get the budget in place before we can make decisions
right,
about
maybe
how
that's
to
where I should have started that. There is
the
no
surplus,
budget.
Right?
Yeah, right. There is no budget in place.
You know, hard for me to know what the issues are that are out there. You know, if we believe the governor, if he's been working with the legislature and it's something that that folks have put together, then, you know, I guess I'd believe him on his face on that.
Right.
But for me, I'm more focused on let's get the big budget done.
Right. So what about that, Jim? I mean, this comes at a time when Massachusetts is the last state in the country without a permanent spending plan for fiscal year 2019. The House and the Senate still have to reconcile differences in their two spending packages, right? What's up with that?
I think what's up with that is some real disagreement as to a couple of big issues. I would say on the education funding piece, this additional revenue is manna from heaven. It, by the way, it did come through that tax cut. It's a one-time deal for the most part, I think. So spending it on new hires and that sort of thing, even if they're social workers and all the rest, you're going to have to carry that tail with you. So the question would be, do you put it more towards capital? Do you put it to things that are one-timers to some degree? One thing that's clear about the conversation about education funding, Anthony, is that the 1993 Education Reform Act grand bargain of reforms for revenue is dead in the sense that no one's talking about any more reforms. No one's talking about additional vocational technical schools. No one's talking about some more school-based management. Forget the charters. This is just a straight out, let's go for more money. And there's no real conversation around what's driving up spending on the healthcare side or on the benefit side. It's just more money. So my gut is that Governor Baker probably doesn't get all that hardening. I think it's going to go towards status quo.
Interesting. Susan, you're a former state rep, so give us some, I don't know, insight into what happens up there when you've got sort of the House and the Senate sort of taking too much time or needing more time to reconcile what's going on to come up with these. You're looking really skeptical.
Well, I'm looking at you and thinking, none of this is new. I mean, this is what happens every year. I mean, this session ends on July 31st. I know the budget was supposed to be done on July 1st, but they carry that over with, you know, 1/52nd budgets. And, you know, so the bills still get paid. It's not a Washington stoppage where the bills stop getting paid. It's classic horse trading, you know, and there are differences between the House and Senate, and the differences lie in the size of the body. You know, when you have 160 members on one side and you have 40 on the other, it's just inherently very different, right? You're going to have sort of more conservative power. You're going to have, I always say the power that you have as a legislator is not always the power to accomplish things, but the real power is the ability to stop things.
Right.
So you use your stopping ability as leverage to get what you want. It's horse trading. There's some policy differences, and I'm pretty confident that at 12:01 on July 31st, we'll have it all. Not everything done, but
all
a lot.
All right. So one quick thing before we leave Beacon Hill. One area where lawmakers acted before the deadline, automatic voter registration. The Senate unanimously passed a bill Thursday intended to encourage more participation in elections by enrolling voters when they interact essentially with the Registry of Motor Vehicles or Mass Health, unless they opt out. This sounds like a pretty good idea. Right, Jim?
You get a lot of people enrolled. Doesn't mean they're going to end up voting, but it gives them the opportunity to vote.
Right.
And I think that's just a fine thing.
Right. And we're seeing, Susan, a lot of examples of voter suppression laws around the country. This seems to go in exactly the opposite direction.
Yeah. When you saw the numbers with which those bills were carried in the House and Senate, you know there's a lot of support for doing this.
All right. So finally, let's move on to our hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week that maybe were below the fold. Jim, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, you know that it's Friday the 13th, right?
I hadn't even thought of that, but of course it is.
Of course it is. Well, you know, many of us have
Got 40 minutes of live programming left. I'm a little worried.
As I was driving here, I was looking behind, trying to see if the lightning was going to strike. You know, there are people like me who worry about that, but not the Philippine President Duterte. This week, one poll has him losing 11% of his support. As is evidenced by his execution of people on the streets. He doesn't really care terribly much about things like that. He's not worried about polls. His reaction was, I don't care. Make it 15%. It doesn't matter to me. He doesn't care about bad luck either. In a very Catholic country, he has called Pope Francis a son of you-know-what and called God even stupid. This week, he pledged to resign if anyone can prove that God exists. Now, that's a really good question, by the way. He mocked original sin as tainting innocent infants, and he ridiculed the clergy for having people pay to remove that original sin. At his most thoughtful, at a science and technology event, could you imagine him speaking at a science and technology event? Mm. He said, where is the logic of God? In a more relaxed mode, he exclaimed, who is this stupid God?
Good God.
According to that poll, he has seen his approval rating slip to around 65 to 70%, by the way.
Wow. Wow. Okay. How not to run a campaign in a country like that. Okay. Susan, you're...
Well, I'm not going to go the heathen route, but I find myself loving good stories these days and things that make me happy. And I think the happiest I was this week was when those boys came out of the cave in Thailand. I just felt like that was just a high. But for an incredible story within the incredible story, I was really taken by the boy. I'm going to hope I don't ruin his name here, Adul Samon, 14 years old, one of the players. He's from Wah, the state of Wah in Myanmar. He speaks five languages, English, Thai, Burmese, and Mandarin. And he was the one who, when they arrived, was able to speak English and say, you know, we're okay. And he worked with the Australian divers and helped them get out. And I just found, you know, and he's stateless, by the way, because he can't have a passport because he has no international status. And I just thought, like, wow, here's a wonderful story that has a wonderful story within it. And so many great stories in that story.
Well, that certainly was a rare bit of really good news. Okay, so I'm sort of along the same vein. It's summer. It's the weekend. So my hubbub has to be about the Red Sox and that incredible at-bat last night by Mookie Betts against the Toronto Blue Jays. Okay, so I'm sure most people know what happened, but we're going to play the tape because it's so much fun. So Red Sox down by a run in the fourth inning, bases loaded, two outs, full count. Betts keeps fouling off pitch after pitch, and then, well, here it is.
Three balls and two strikes. The count is full.
This will be the 13th pitch of the at-bat.
As the lefty comes home. Runners go, swing and a drive. Deep left field. That's a grand slam. Mookie Betts, his fourth career grand slam. And the Red Sox.
Okay, so that was pretty damn electrifying.
That was awesome. I watched that live, and I can keep listening to
that. Yeah, it's really fun. But here's why this is my hubbub. Okay, so that wasn't exactly a hubbub. A lot of people paid attention to that. But this team is on a 10-game winning streak, 3.5 games in front of New York. Mookie Betts, J.D. Martinez, Chris Sale's unhittable. It seems like it's an extraordinary season in the making. I'm not sensing that people are really picking up on that yet. So I don't know. That's my hubbub. It's like this needs to be more than a hubbub. People need to get really excited about this team. So
I'm in.
That's my thought as we head into this weekend. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
It's good to be with you.
And Susan Tracy, President of the consulting firm The Strategy Group and a former state rep, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Anthony.
Listeners, that's it. Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to have a few tips for staying safe in the water amidst a spike in drownings this summer. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The hot summer weather means time to enjoy the beach and swimming in the region's many lakes and ponds. That's a source of great joy for most, but it also brings risk. And in fact, there's been a troubling spike in drownings in Massachusetts recently. The latest came last night in Pocasset Harbor on Cape Cod, where a man drowned. It's one of at least 10 drownings in the past few weeks. The victims have been as old as 76, as young as 2 years old. So we're going to talk now a little bit about the causes of all these drownings, if there's a pattern, how to stay safe in the water. And to help us do that, Kevin Whalen joins us. He's the director of aquatics at the Department of Conservation and Recreation of Massachusetts. And Kevin Whalen, thanks for joining us. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So can you explain how officials like yourself are trying to make sense of this recent spike in drownings? It seems like a lot. And suddenly, are there any patterns that are emerging that you're noticing?
Well, I think one of the patterns that you do see is that in many of the cases, it's been all in, like, you know, where lifeguards are not supervising. Yeah. I don't believe there is any in one of the locations that there was a lifeguard present. So I think it's important for people, especially that people have their skill level is not as, people's skill level is, you know, might not be a strong swimmer, that they, you know, swim in designated swim areas. DCR has, you know, several properties across the whole state, many, many ocean beaches as well that we, you know, we provide lifeguard service, but also we provide designated swim areas across the state at many of our state parks where we have lifeguard coverage as well. And, of course, we have 25 deep water pools and wading pools and things of that nature as well.
I'm wondering, does the heat affect the frequency of these accidents? I mean, obviously, we know more people are likely to be swimming when it's hot, but what about their bodies? Do folks need to be thinking about avoiding dehydration, heat strokes, that kind of stuff?
Right. I think, you know, absolutely. I think, you know, people have to make sure that they're, you know, they have all their faculties. They shouldn't be drinking alcohol, you know, when they're going to be going swimming or go into the water, and they should be hydrated. You know, if they're not strong swimmers or if they have young children, they should be wearing a life jacket that's U.S. Coast Guard approved. I think that's always something that would be beneficial for everyone. Of course, if you're in a boat or a kayak or things of that nature, you should always be wearing a Coast Guard approved life jacket as well.
Right. We also, as bystanders, you know, I mean, we hear stories about people drowning while they're trying to save another person. What's the advice there? I mean, obviously, if someone's in distress, you're going to try to help them.
Right.
But what kind of, I mean, how should we be thinking about that?
I you know, obviously, if you do see that a lot. And I think one of the things is I think it starts with the person that it's going into the water, that they need to make sure that they know their surroundings and that, you know, you don't swim alone. I know it is very tragic, obviously, when someone tries to help another person that might be struggling to, you know, and obviously they succumb to the same thing. But I think it's important, though, that, you know, the people, before they go to swim, that they swim with other people, that they take the precautions of whether it's life jackets, things of that nature, that they know, you know, where they're swimming. We had a drowning last year out at Walden Pond, which was, you know, outside the designated area, and, you know, the cove was like a 50-foot across cove, and the person thought they could walk across, and, you know, there was a 12-foot drop-off. Now, you know, we had posted no swimming there and all of that, but the problem is that, you know, that's why we have the designated swim areas. We check for sudden drop-offs. We make sure that it's safe for people to, you know, to swim in. There's no obstructions under the water, and it's only about, you know, 6 feet deep at the deepest. So all those factors, I think, go in. So especially if you're not a strong swimmer, I think it's important that you do stay in designated swim areas. As far as, you know, your question, as far as, you know, when people go in, I mean, obviously that's it's spur of the moment, and it, you know, where it happens and all those things that make it very difficult to kind of plan for something like that.
Yeah.
But it's really kind of, I think the onus is on the people that are going in the water that get themselves in trouble to begin with, to take the necessary precautions, you know, prior to going in the water.
You know, I was really sad to read about one of the drowning victims was a 2-year-old boy who drowned in a pool in Lynn. And this made us think here in the newsroom about some of the misconceptions around drowning. And if you're watching a kid, or maybe you're not watching a kid as closely as you should be, because when someone drowns, it's not necessarily the huge sort of splashy scene that we might associate with someone. So can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it can happen suddenly and quietly, right?
Exactly. And that's usually most of the time, because what people are trying to do, they're trying to like, you know, get air into their lungs. So they're trying to like lift their heads up. And by doing that, generally speaking, their arms usually sometimes go down to the side. I mean, there is no typical way of drowning, but a lot of times that's what you see. So it is much more silent than people, I think, realize. And, you know, it's obviously lifeguards and things like that are trained to watch those as they do their surveillance, are trained to watch for those type of actions by folks in the water. But it is not like a loud thing where people are yelling and screaming, because the person is usually struggling to get breath.
Yeah.
And so that is, one of the things that, it is accurate. So I do think, getting back to like young children, though, I think what people need to do, obviously we talked about the life jacket, but when you have a party or any time around the pool, there has to be one, dedicated person that is watching the water.
Really watching the water and watching the kids.
Everybody can be having a barbecue and enjoying themselves, but all the time I think you need, you do need to have that one person that is dedicated to watching the water, and that's their responsibility to make sure that they're watching all the children in the pool.
Wise words from Kevin Whalen, and Director of Aquatics at the Department of Conservation and Recreation in Massachusetts. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And listeners, you can find more information about how to stay safe in the water at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The new film, Eighth Grade, stars Elsie Fisher, who plays Kayla, a smart but sometimes excruciatingly awkward girl struggling with that difficult transition from middle school to high school. Kayla's world is dominated by social media, cliques, who's popular and pretty and who's not. And it opens with Kayla's vlog or video blog, in which she talks about being yourself. Here's a scene from the trailer.
Hey guys, it's Kayla, back with another video. So, the topic of today's video is being yourself. Being yourself can be hard, and it's like, aren't I always being myself? And yeah, for sure. But being yourself is like not changing yourself to impress someone else.
Okay, so Eighth Grade reminds us that middle school can be, among other things, hell. It was written and directed by Bo Burnham, a comedian and actor who got his start on YouTube. It's his first feature-length film. It debuted at the Sundance Film Festival, and it will hit theaters in Boston July 20th. And Bo Burnham, who grew up in Hamilton, Mass., stopped by a few days ago to talk about the film. So this is such a visceral and powerful depiction of what it's like to be a 13-year-old, right? Now, at least that's what I took away from it. Tell us what inspired this film.
Well, yeah, that was part of the inspiration, was wanting to tell a story that was not nostalgic. A lot of movies in this space tend to be remembered, and I like remembered movies, but I wanted to make a movie that was visceral, because I do believe the way that this age feels is different than the way it is remembered by adults. And I also think that kids are experiencing something different than I experienced in 2003 or someone experienced in another decade because of technology and because of the culture. So that was the inspiration, wanting to talk about the internet, wanting to talk about feelings around the internet, to maybe have a conversation about the internet that's a little subtler than Russia, or cyberbullying, to do a sort of a granular look at.
Well, I want to ask you about the internet, but I wanted just to focus on Kayla first. Mm. She's played by Elsie Fisher, clearly a smart and thoughtful girl, but she's not one of the cool girls. She's not one of the super popular girls, not one of the super pretty girls. And she spends a lot of time trying to be a better, more popular version of herself as she prepares for high school. Can you talk a little bit about her character, Kayla?
Yeah, I mean, she's voted most quiet, which was a superlative I had in my school when I was in middle school, which I couldn't believe that, parents would do that, or teachers would do that, because it felt like no kid self-identifies as shy. But yeah, it is someone who is seen as shy by the world, but has a real want to express herself and better herself in the world, which I think everyone does to a certain degree. The movie's sort of about her in this last week of school making one final attempt to bridge the gap between where she thought she would be at this point and where she actually is. But hopefully, it really is saying, a 13-year-old girl can be a conduit for the human condition as much as a 60-year-old male poet in the woods can be.
Interesting. So talk about the effect of the internet, because you said you wanted to create a film that really showed what it felt like to be alive now. And one of the dominant forces in the world right now, particularly for these young people, are smartphones. They're glued to these devices. So how did you want to depict the effect of this technology on these kids?
Yeah, well, part of it was just that, just to depict the effect and to not prescribe, to not do a TED Talk. Sometimes when we talk about the internet, it feels like in culture we're talking about it prescriptively as parents, as worriers, rather than, for me, anyone that knows enough about the internet doesn't have any solid ground under their feet to talk about it. It feels like to know the internet is to be awash in it and drowning in it and grasping for meaning. Mm. So that's sort of the portrayal of it, to say, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's good or bad. It's sort of neutral. It's two things at once. She's hyper-connected. She's lonely. She's overstimulated. She's numb. But she's these things at the same time. And it's just portraying, what does it feel like to go to bed at the end of the day and to choose between every piece of information in the history of the world on your phone or the back of your eyelids? And that's what it sort of feels like, having to sweep between these two big binaries. And also, I think the internet does sort of force kids to watch themselves and not live in themselves. They sort of hover over themselves, watching themselves live their life, watch other people watch them live their life, watch other people watch them live their life. You know, yeah. There's a weird sort of meta, out-of-body, disassociative thing that happens. And the movie just hopefully portrays it in a little way, and to show that the sort of classic things of being young, of wanting to be perceived as something, to want to change yourself, yeah. to be worried about the way peers think of you. The internet just really...
It really reinforces that.
Yeah, and exacerbates. Everything's just bigger. It's not, and hopefully everyone can relate to it, but also be sensitive to the fact that something very strange is happening right now, and we're not really taking inventory of it.
And you've sort of been aware, and in some of your work talked about the sort of criticism that I think it's a criticism that you have, or at least a concern that you have about this. And it's interesting because in many ways, the launch of your career was, you know, had a lot to do with the availability of the internet. And I was reading this New York Times profile that talked about you as if the monster turned on Frankenstein in a way.
Yeah. It's very funny. Yeah, people think Frankenstein's the monster, but no, Frankenstein's the doctor.
That's true.
Yeah, right, you know, yeah. You were right. No, you had it right.
No, we had it right. Yeah.
I haven't turned. It's just it's more that I'm not. It's not, the movie's not about, and then she threw her phone in the ocean and then she was happy. You know,
right.
It's not meant to indict the internet. It's just meant to talk about it honestly. And it means something to me. That's why I'm talking about it this way.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I don't want it to be scare tactic or anything, but I just want it to, you know, be described correctly.
Yeah. So when I see what these what social media. Well, I mean, here's an example that you depict really well in the film. These kids are always glued. Their eyes are always down. And I don't actually want to pick on these kids. I think we adults are guilty of the same thing.
We've also made a really bad world for them to look up at as well. I mean,
that's an interesting way to put it.
You know.
But I was watching the film and I just wanted to scream, take your eyes off the screen and look at each other, talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And it sort of made me think, you know, is the genie out of the bottle for good, or can we somehow stuff it back in and sort of turn away or turn this to better effect?
I mean, I think the genie's out. I mean, some people think it's going to be cyclical and kids are going to unplug. But at a certain point, like, not everything's cyclical. Sometimes the Model T shows up and there are no more horses.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the movie talks about a sort of classic asymmetry between that you'd rather have 100 meaningless connections in front of you than one that's staring across from you at the dinner table.
Yeah.
But they're not meaningless. That's the thing, too. Like, she is connecting with people online. She is expressing herself online. That is good. And it's bad. That's what I'm trying to at least portray with this thing, is that there, I don't have a resolution. I don't have a point of view.
Right.
That's probably a bad thing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When these 13-year-olds grow up to become social scientists, I'll be very curious to hear what they have to say about the internet.
Yeah.
But until then, it's just like, I feel like we should just sort of take inventory maybe of what's happening, you know, and then let them speak with authority on it, because I just don't think there's enough information to speak with authority on the internet yet.
Interesting. Well, I want to play a little tape from your world on the internet, because you made your name, especially among younger people, as a YouTube comedian early on. Some of the first videos you posted to YouTube were all shot in your room. So here's a moment from one of them.
Oh, boy.
Hi, internet. It's been a while. I wrote this song for you, and it's about something that's usually pretty boring, math, and it makes it fun. It's called New Math. 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's do it. What's a pirate minus the ship? Just a creative homeless guy and an anteater.
All right, we're back. Bo Burnham, you were sort of... you weren't real comfortable with listening to that.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. It wasn't an effort to make.
No, it wasn't. No. It's like you listen to something you did when you were 16 and see if you don't squirm at it. No. Everyone's welcome to do it. These things are on the internet for everyone to look at. It's so hard for me to, part of the reason this movie is me going back and forgiving myself and going like, not forgiving myself specifically, but going like re-examining the cringy things you post on the internet when you're in eighth grade. I mean, when that was posted, I was 3 years out of eighth grade.
Yeah.
And these things are immortalized forever.
Well, the reason I wanted to play that, and it really wasn't my intention to make want to sort of say Kayla, too, is doing something on the internet. My sense is, unlike your work, she's getting like 5 viewers. But how much did you see yourself in Kayla?
I see myself more in her now than I did then, truly.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I was definitely wanting to express myself on the internet at that age, and she's doing that as well. I mean, when I was her age, there really wasn't an internet to express yourself on in the same degree. But my sort of anxiety didn't sort of awaken until I was probably a sophomore in high school. I think girls, on average, not to be cruel to the boys or whatever, but just tend to have slightly deeper experiences a little earlier. For whatever reason, maybe culturally imposed or innate, whatever. But yeah, I see myself in her. You know, I was having panic attacks, you know, backstage at the Schubert Theater instead of before a pool party in a bathroom. But the feelings are the same. And that was the hope to say, look at this 13-year-old girl and say, I can see myself in you now. We are the same. We feel the same. It doesn't just have to be. This isn't a story about my younger daughter or my younger self necessarily.
So, interesting question. Kayla is so believable, and there's a sort of harsh realism to this film and a lot of raw, unfiltered feelings. And I'm thinking of one scene in particular. It's right before the pool party, and the girls are all sort of lined up for a photograph. And Kayla, obviously a little uncomfortable in her bathing suit and her body, is kind of hiding behind the other girls, and she kind of gets pulled out in front of them. No, Kayla, we got to see you too. Come on out. It was such a painful moment to watch. I felt so badly for her. But here's my question. How did you tap into that so well? I mean, you're a guy, and you really directed this girl really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't love pool parties. I wasn't, like, psyched about my body. I don't know if anyone is in eighth grade. But, yeah, it was, in terms of how I was directing a girl, it was, I mean, I was very aware of being a man in this position the entire time and just tried to subjugate myself to her truth and told her all the time, you know what this is, not me. You show me what it's like. You are the expert on this. And also just, again, to just trust that I could know her. Yes. Believing that I could understand her let me understand her.
Right.
If I had approached her like this alien of a, you know, people write movies about World War I soldiers, you know what I mean? And like creatures that live in volcanoes. I can understand a girl, you know?
Yeah.
I felt that way.
How did you find Elsie Fisher? She was so good in this role.
Yeah, she's pretty special. I found a clip of her online being interviewed for something. And brought her in, auditioned every kid sort of under the sun. Every other kid, when they played the role, it felt like a confident kid pretending to be shy. She was the only one that felt like a shy kid pretending to be confident, which is the role. Yeah, it was really, there was never a second choice. It was like the lights were on when she read. And it really, to bring Frankenstein back, it really was that. It was like, it's alive for the first time when she read it.
That's great. So I was talking to my very great producer, Zoe, who's your age, and she said something really interesting about this film, that it's really the only one that depicts in a real way how young people are using the internet and social media. And given how prevalent all this is in our society, why is that? I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, there are not a lot of films out there that really delve into it the way you have.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, thank you, Zoe. I think a problem I see with the internet portrayed in media is that it's always portrayed too significantly. If they're going to portray the internet, it'll be a huge plot device. Something will go viral. I'm very happy to have a movie where someone doesn't go viral. As opposed to just having the internet be atmosphere, part of their life.
Yeah.
Just something that's happening, not something that is immediately significant. It's not like, ooh, I sent a picture here, or, oh my gosh, I FaceTimed my mom by accident. Like, it's like these things just exist. So I think that's the hope, I think, of the movie, is that it just portrays it without commentary. It portrays it as it is in our lives, which is already integrated. when you sometimes you see kids in movies and they're going like, oh my gosh, that was hashtag savage. And you're like, no, kids don't talk like that. Like, that's how a 40-year-old thinks a kid talks. It's integrated way more subtly into their life. They're not thinking about it. I think as younger people that actually grew up with the internet like me are start to make things, you will see the internet be portrayed a little more emotionally and less as this – less satirized, because it's like, how do you – why satirize the internet? The internet's already self-satirizing and ironic and
– right. It's sort of like, why satirize oxygen? I mean, it's just part of the atmosphere.
Yeah, and it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to satirize memes? You're going to satirize like a – it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't go anywhere.
So, Bo, what are you working on next?
Hopefully just, you know, taking some time off this and just sort of banging my head against a wall trying to think of something. I'm not good at multitasking, so it'll just be like sitting alone and trying to write again.
I'm really sort of glad to hear that. I'm really tired of talking to super talented people who are like finished one incredible movie and they're already telling me about the next one.
Oh, so, don't worry. You got a moderately talented person who's taking things one step at a time, baby.
All right. So that's Bo Burnham. He's the writer and director of the movie Eighth Grade, which debuted at the Sundance Film Festival. It hits theaters in Boston on July 20th. Bo Burnham, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today and this week. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. Renee Marchando engineered our show today. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend, and join us again Monday on Radio Boston.